Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Tanisha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on chronic myelogenous leukemia, or CML. It's from the 2010 American Society of Hematology, or ASH, annual meeting. And this is, I know this is information that many of you have really wanted to hear about, and this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and 23 other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 853 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions of the United States and different states as well and different locales. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Korea, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. It's a bit of a global call. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline of what our speakers will be covering. There's information about our speakers. There also is a number of references to resources that you can use, all the different collaborating organizations, as really helpful resources for all of you to utilize going forth. And they're just 800 numbers and websites as well. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you each to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics that you want us to offer in these programs? So, and indeed, today's program was one that you have, really many of you have recommended that we offer this program, and so here it is. And so we try very much to implement what you ask for. So please let us know what you want, and we'll try very hard. Your feedback is really critically important to us. It's our dialogue, to some extent, with each of you telling us what you want. Now, today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. We have wonderful speakers on the program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is Associate Professor, Center for Hematologic Malignancies, Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University. And Dr. Morrow is going to address an overview of CML, new treatment approaches reported at ASH, and doctor-patient communication. I now turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, good evening, good afternoon, good morning, everyone. Buenas noches, buenos dias, buongiorno, buenas suerte. I would like to welcome everyone to the call from wherever you are, and thanks for joining us. So, yes, my task is to describe a few of the topics Carolyn mentioned, and let's just start and talk about the disease we're going to review tonight, which is CML. CML, as I bet many of you know, is a unique disease. It's not one of the most common of the hematologic malignancies, but interestingly, it's become quite apparent that it is becoming a disease that many are able to live well with and survive. So it's becoming a more prevalent disease with the incidence or the number of people living with CML, for example, in the United States, doubling at a regular interval. And what used to be a rare disease actually will become a somewhat more common disease as, again, people are surviving and doing quite well. It's a unique disease in with regards to its biology and its underpinnings. It's one of the only human cancers that is essentially linked to a sole genetic anomaly, the Philadelphia chromosome. It's a disease of the blood with excess production of blood cells driven by this Philadelphia chromosome anomaly and the ensuing BCR-ABL signaling or protein that's created. And this biology was clarified over decades of hard basic science work that laid the groundwork for a tremendous advance over a decade. And I would say that in 2010, we've ended a tremendous decade of advance in this disease, going from a condition that was quite treatable with many options, but one that is actually now highly treatable and essentially functionally curable with very low-risk therapy. The ASH meeting in 2010 was always exciting, but I think we'd all acknowledge that we are getting down to the fine-tuning of the CML original therapy options. We're seeing advances in new therapy options, and we're learning more and clarifying our ability to judge response and help patients navigate through their response with multiple different treatment options. The original trial using targeted therapy in CML was a trial using Gleevec or imatinib, and this trial continues to be updated and rounded out each year. And we've learned a tremendous amount from this study, which, again, was the first time imatinib or Gleevec was used in patients with chronic phase CML first diagnosed. In comparison to interferon, Gleevec was a hands-down winner and has really provided now, with 8 and 9 years follow-up, a prolonged, tremendous survival advantage, durable remissions in an overwhelming majority of patients, and excellent tolerability. We've seen no new concerning late side effects develop. We've clarified again the timing of response that patients should achieve who have CML, namely a prompt blood remission, an early cytogenetic remission or bone marrow remission, particularly at 6 and 12 months, patients showing some signs, and then a complete remission within a year's time. And we've began to focus on molecular response, or response that's measured by molecular testing called PCR. And there we're looking for a major response in that category by 18 months. And these all put patients in the highest category of success. We have begun to push the envelope even greater, however, when it comes to the development of not first generation or Gleevec therapy, but second generation kinase inhibitors. In the last few years, we've seen aggressive study and approval of not one but two drugs used in the second-line setting for the situation when imatinib fails, when patients have intolerable side effects to imatinib, and we've seen longer follow-up from these studies, which show a very high rate of salvage or rescue for patients who are just simply unable to take Gleevec or imatinib, and for patients who have lost response or who never, unfortunately, achieved response with Gleevec or imatinib. These drugs have been studied and now approved in 2010 for use in the first-line setting. So 2010 was a paradigm shift. We saw imatinib needing to step down off the podium, if you will, in some sense, and make room, really, for two other drugs, nilotinib or Tasigna, and dasatinib or Spicel, to join Gleevec as first-line treatment options. They clearly, in studies, have shown an advantage in putting patients into higher, or putting a higher number of patients into relevant remissions, bone marrow remissions or cytogenetic remissions, more importantly, molecular remissions, which likely bode the best for long-term stable remission and long-term good outcome. They have an excellent side effect profile with minimal added toxicities, essentially little or no added penalty for the gain in response, perhaps a bit more myelosuppression with one, and some new side effects which need to be followed under doctor's care or hematologist care with both, but no major side effects of concern, and again, a real gain with regards to response in the frontline or first treatment setting. To highlight one last study or topic that was covered at ASH this year is the question of what do we do when Gleevec or imatinib isn't worked or has not worked or it wasn't tolerable, but more often when it hasn't worked. And we move to a second approach, either dasatinib or nilotinib, or in some cases both, and that hasn't worked as well. We clearly, as an extension of our understanding of the disease biology of CML, driven by the Philadelphia chromosome, and BCR-ABL, which is the abnormal protein, we know that this protein, as it's expressed and made in leukemia cells, can undergo mutation or alteration. And over approximately half of patients in whom this situation arises, where multiple different therapy options aren't working, will have a mutation or alteration in BCR-ABL or other mechanisms. Some we know and some we don't, although we feel we understand the majority of the causes that are the root cause. And we've seen development now of third-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. One of particular promise is a drug which goes by the name ponatinib, or its experimental name of AP24534. This is a compound which is developed in the same vein as imantinib, Gleevec, and nilotinib and dasatinib. It is an oral therapy, which can it seems to be best taken once a day, which is extremely well tolerated. And now we have a therapy that is able to salvage or treat patients who haven't responded to two or three therapies, seem at in a position where no good options exist. And the response rates were quite exciting in the original studies, the phase one trial, where we established that the drug is safe, and now we have a dose to move forward with to study in larger numbers of patients. For patients with the most highly recognized and selective form of resistance, something which goes by the name of a T315I mutation, which is a selective form of resistance where the BCR-ABL protein changes in a way where none of the three drugs currently approved is able to work. This drug is highly effective, putting an overwhelming majority of patients into blood and bone marrow remission, and it works in the majority of cases for all patients in whom this setting has developed. So now we have 10-plus years of history with imantinib or Gleevec showing its ability to put patients into stable long-term remission. We've learned with greater clarity about how not only cytogenetic, but how molecular response, and even complete molecular response, which is a bit of a misnomer, because it's more the sense that we don't have technology which is able to measure every last cell, but we see many patients whose disease burden falls below the level of our detection. How this may translate into a new goal or a new plateau, new landmark response, which may be achievable in higher numbers of patients and may translate into a new era again in CML with regards to its implications. We've seen, again, drugs that were developed for Gleevec resistance or Gleevec intolerance approved and now sharing the podium, if you will, and able to be used in the frontline setting. Many would say that these drugs really should be preferred in the frontline setting. I think the CML field in general is still carefully placing these therapies with the advantage they give and a lack of some, in some sense, our ability to judge beforehand who needs which medication. I think it really behooves us to use these drugs upfront in the frontline setting, and patients newly diagnosed should be looking for those discussions, i.e. using nilotinib or dasatinib in the frontline setting. The excitement about the third-generation compound and its ability to work when no other drugs can is incredible. So we have covered many of the chinks in the armor. As patients are diagnosed and loved ones share the news and hematologists or oncologists are accessed and the discussions ensue, it's so important to have a good and open level of communication between the doctor and patient, or the doctor, the patient, the family, or all those involved. The information flow early in the course of diagnosis to understand what these therapies can do, which therapy options exist, how to manage side effects, what the role of testing is, both in the beginning, during, and over time during therapy, what types of testing will be done, what landmarks of response are important, what am I looking for, are so important to understand. And as a hematologist, I'm proud of my patients who are able to keep a high level and open level of communication with me. It's important to sort of do your homework and to use resources like those provided at Cancer Care and other charitable organizations which educate us and help support patients with blood cancers and other cancers. And as a physician, I can't emphasize enough how important that communication is. It helps foster a treatment algorithm which is best suited for the patient, the opportunity to use every option available, including clinical trials, and it allows for early recognition of problems such as side effects, inadequate response, and early action on questions as they arise. There should be no mysteries about this diagnosis, about what's going on, what the test results are showing, and where the future is going. I think I'll stop here, and because I know we have many other topics to talk about, and one of my colleagues will join us now.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Morrow, for just doing a fantastic presentation, wonderful overview for everybody, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Neal Shah, and Dr. Shah is Assistant Professor, Division of Hematology Oncology, University of California, San Francisco. And Dr. Shah is going to address how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, understanding the important role of adherence, taking your pills on schedule, and quality of life concerns. I now turn the program over to Dr. Shah.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to let me discuss these topics with you. First, I'd like to discuss the issue of the importance of clinical trials to furthering our understanding of what treatments may best benefit patients and what treatments may ultimately be widely available to patients. And I'll just start with what may be a little bit of a sobering statistic, and that is that only 5% of adult cancer patients participate in cancer clinical trials. And the reason, of course, that this is rather disheartening is because we know that cancers of many types have been not so easy to treat over the years, and we definitely need to identify new effective therapies that will hopefully benefit a larger number of patients than what we've done in the past. And every treatment that we have that's approved for pretty much any disease, whether it's a cancer or not, goes through a rigorous process of evaluation in clinical trials. And clinical trials typically are conducted in three sequential phases. So if there's a new compound or drug that somebody has an idea that may be active, the very first step is to, first of all, convince the U.S. Food and Drug Administration that there's enough rationality, there's enough rationale with what is understood about how the compound works in a laboratory setting to consider using it and testing it in people. And the first step is what we call a phase one clinical trial, where typically the goal is to determine first and foremost whether or not this new treatment is safe, because of course above all else we want to try to do everything we can to avoid doing harm to anybody. And this involves participation of patients in studies of which they may or may not benefit, but until we can figure out whether or not a therapy is safe, we cannot, of course, move ahead to test it in larger studies to determine if it is effective. So phase two studies are designed to do exactly that. Once a compound is felt to be safe, it is typically assessed in a phase two study, where the primary goal is to obtain some idea of how effective it is at treating a particular disease. If it is deemed effective as a result of that process, it will typically undergo evaluation in a phase three study, in which patients would be, in most cases, treated either with the newer experimental therapy or with something that was considered the standard of care. Now, just to be entirely clear about this, in almost all instances, patients are not treated with or not allowed to participate in studies or exposed to certain medications unless there it is clear that other effective and available approved agents are no longer of benefit to these patients. And so, as you can imagine, every therapy that we've had that's been approved has gone through some form of this rigorous testing. And without question, this pays a lot of attention to safety, and this paves the road for drugs like all the ones that Dr. Morrow mentioned. And I've certainly been fortunate to be involved in the very first trials of imatinib, dasatinib, and ponatinib, and have actually seen firsthand that participation in clinical trials, and even in phase one clinical trials, can, in some cases, I think really mean the difference between living and dying for some people. And so I would encourage you all to consider participation in clinical trials, certainly with the hope that it would benefit you, and also with the hope that somebody else may benefit from your participation, because we obviously do owe a huge amount of gratitude to the people who so bravely went before us through this process of participating in clinical trials, and from whose experience we learned which drugs were safe and effective. And so these are the real true unsung heroes of clinical research. So one of the things that, of course, has been very exciting about this class of medications that Dr. Morrow has been discussing is that we found out very early on in the very early clinical trials of all these agents that people that had a disease which was felt may be responsive to these therapies, that a good proportion of patients actually showed evidence of response. And so certainly in CML, we have a good degree a good track history of learning most of the things, most of the important things about these new therapies very early on in the course of clinical trial development. So if you want to know about a resource that you can look at as far as participation in clinical trials, there are a number of nonprofit organizations that have reference material. Also, there's a site, it's clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V, that lists a large number of ongoing clinical trials. And of course, as Dr. Morrow has mentioned, we've made great strides in the treatment of chronic myeloid leukemia, but there still is some work to be done. And this centers upon, in my opinion, two or three areas, one of which is probably applicable to most people listening here today, and that is how do we go from taking this disease, which is now very effectively treated, but with the expectation that people will probably require years of treatment, if not lifelong treatment, how do we take it from that type of a disease to one in which we can definitively cure so that people can stop therapy altogether? And there are actually a number of ongoing clinical trials to address this right now. And if you are interested in being evaluated to see if you might be able to participate in the study, I would certainly encourage you to certainly contact one of us or to go to one of the sites that I mentioned earlier. So that is one particular area that's being addressed in clinical trials. And another area is how do we improve upon how well patients are doing in the more advanced phases of the disease. We know these tyrosine kinase inhibitors are very effective in the chronic phase, but in patients with accelerated and blast phase disease, although they're initially effective in a good proportion of patients, most patients, unfortunately, have relapsed disease quite quickly, and we need to make further strides in the treatment and outcomes of patients with the more advanced phase of the disease. So those are, I think, you know, a couple areas that are of particular importance right now as the frontier, as Dr. Morrow has said, has been changing over the past several years. And is likely to continue to evolve, but these, as I see, are currently the most exciting areas ongoing in terms of clinical research in chronic myeloid leukemia. Now, I want to talk about one important issue, which is the important role of what we call treatment adherence. Adherence refers to the ability to adhere to prescribed treatment. So, as you all know, the therapies that are prescribed for this disease that Dr. Morrow mentioned are all meant to be taken essentially on a daily basis under the supervision of a physician. And there have been some studies that have been done which are rather eye-opening and show that if patients who are treated with imatinib are more adherent, and by more adherent it means they take at least 90% of their prescribed doses of imatinib, and so this would be anybody who misses no more than 3 days out of a typical month of their imatinib, that their likelihood of achieving a very deep response on imatinib over about a 4 to 5 year period approaches 90%. In contrast, patients who have less than a 90% rate of taking their imatinib have only about a 15% chance of achieving this deep level of remission. And it's becoming clear that this deep level of molecular remission probably translates to improved outcomes over a period of years. And so I know it can be certainly understandable that people can get to a point where it feels like the disease is not so much of a threat, but I certainly think this is very important information. We've made tremendous strides in our ability to treat this disease, and there's really nothing more tragic than people who unfortunately miss out on the opportunity to benefit from this because they think incorrectly that it's okay for them to skip doses. So if there are reasons for why doses are missed, such as side effects and so on, I would strongly encourage you to discuss that with your physician. Of course, nobody wants to take any type of medication if they don't have to, and all medications can be associated with side effects, and these drugs are no different in that regard. On the whole, they tend to be generally quite well tolerated by patients, but there are some patients who have significant side effects on one or the other medication. Now, the great news is, of course, that we don't have to put all of our eggs in the imatinib basket. So if you're having tolerability issues with imatinib and you want to see if you may feel better on either dasatinib or nilotinib, I think that's something you should consider discussing with your physician. It's certainly been my clinical experience that many patients tolerate these newer drugs better than imatinib. There are a fair number of patients who have issues with imatinib that are not necessarily what we would call medically severe or life-threatening, but are felt by patients to be severe, and that's an important issue. And if you communicate that with your doctor, and you mention to your doctor that that it's bothersome enough to where you want to try some other form of therapy, in my opinion, there's no opportunity lost by switching to a newer medication because you always have the ability to go back to imatinib should you decide that you don't like the side effects on the newer medication. We do think the newer medications are every bit as effective as imatinib and more so, and clinical trials are now backing this up. And so I think quality of life is obviously something we need to pay very close attention to, because this can impact the issue of adherence that I discussed a moment ago and can keep people from taking their prescribed doses of medication, which is probably the single most or one of the single most important things that will maximize the likelihood of them doing well for years and hopefully, of course, decades. So with that, I'd like to turn this back over to the moderator.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Shah, just for a very informative and just very thoughtful presentation. I know that there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, a lot of wonderful information, so thank you so much. Just excellent. And our next speaker is Rick Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker, and he is blood cancer's program coordinator and mind-body-spirit project coordinator for cancer care. And Rick is going to present to you the free psychosocial services that are offered by cancer care, and he's also going to talk about the importance of a support network. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate the educational advice of Drs. Morrow and Shaw. It's always a pleasure being on one of these Connect workshops with both of you and hearing your expertise. I'd like to tell you all about Cancer Care's services and how these services can help, and I'd like to tell you about that within the framework that both Drs. Shaw and Morrow introduced about the importance of communication. Many people don't realize their CML is handled by a healthcare team, which usually includes their doctor, an oncology nurse, and social worker, and often other specialists. And while each member of this team specializes in a certain area, they are all working together to coordinate your care. For patients as well as family members, there are numerous issues related to treatment which will impact your lives, such as concerns about insurance, workplace issues, or treatment side effects and their possible impact on normal activities of daily living. These and other questions are common concerns and can create anticipatory anxiety and uncertainty. The good news is that at some point the whole process will become familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. That is why building relationships with all members of your healthcare team is so important. For many, it is helpful to think of this relationship as a partnership or collaboration. Your oncology team are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and your life. And here are some brief tips to guide you. Do your research. The internet is a good place to start, but there are many helpful organizations, such as Cancer Care, that can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will go a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. Take your time. Sometimes saying, I need a day to think about this, can provide an opportunity to catch your breath and get valuable feedback from loved ones and other respected resources before making decisions. And speak up. Don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern to your healthcare team. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body and spirit. Cancer Care has been around for over 60 years. Among our services, we provide information on other resources and strategies for finding help within your community. We provide some financial assistance, counseling interventions with master's degree oncology social workers, and we run regional face-to-face groups as well as national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones. These services can provide emotional support, coping strategies, and validation that you're not alone in what you feel. For many people, counseling, support, groups, education, and resources can go a long way in helping you to confront the difficult challenges of cancer, and daunting as they are, with help, you can find the strength to persevere. Cancer Care can be reached at 1-800-813-HOPE, or online at www.cancercare.org. And I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. Wonderful presentation and really wonderful description of the services of Cancer Care, but also the fact that there is help available from many different sources for everybody on the call, and we want people to take advantage of those services. Thank you. Well, we now have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board. And we're going to ask Trinitha also to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, please call Cancer Care at the end of the call, and we'll be sure to try to address your question. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered, or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Shirley S. Your question, please.
This is for Dr. Shah. You mentioned getting in touch with, quote, one of us. I've been very, very fortunate. I was diagnosed in 93, made it 6.5 years on Gleevec, tried interferon, failed that, started to go on homoherentamine, but my portocath got infected, never got to start that. Started Gleevec, December of 99, and I'm still here. And the only time I have ever been off of it was once very early on in the treatment. My doctor locally decided that I was toxic and gave me a 1 week vacation. And when I had to go back on it, I was sorry that I'd gotten off of it because I felt more fatigued and I had felt so good for that week. But anyway, I've stayed on it faithfully since then, and I think that's so important, and it's not that tough a thing to do. Anyway.
And Shirley, did you have a question you wanted to ask?
Yes, I'd like to know how I get in touch with Dr. Shah. I would like to talk to him about this possibility of being in a study where I would eventually get off of any medication.
Okay, well, thank you for that question, Shirley. And I'm going to ask Dr. Shah to address that in a general way in terms of giving you all the resources because I know many people on the call would like to learn more about how to access information about these trials. Dr. Shah?
So first, you know, I think, you know, first of all, thanks for being one of the pioneers. I mean, you're exactly one of the people I was talking about as one of the unsung heroes, but also a beautiful demonstration of the principle that participating in a clinical trial can really benefit the people who are actually the participants. As you may or may not know, I'm sure as you know, that in the days prior to imatinib, for people who were diagnosed with CML, the estimated survival before we had all these new drugs was only about 5 to 7 years. And here you are 18 years later, and it's, of course, wonderful to hear that you're doing well. I was a little bit confused to hear as to whether or not felt like you felt a whole lot better during that 1 week that you were off of imatinib. I will say that there are some of the side effects of these drugs can be a little bit insidious, and I've had more than one patient who stopped imatinib for a week or so tell me that they didn't realize how good they would feel if they were not taking imatinib. Now, I don't say that to encourage anybody to stop imatinib on a regular basis or interrupt imatinib on a regular basis from time to time, but rather to point out that many people can feel better potentially on some of the newer drugs, and even people who may not think they're potentially suffering from significant fatigue and so on. As I mentioned, there are a good proportion of patients who have told me they never realized how much they were having in terms of imatinib-related side effects until they actually took a little bit of a break from therapy. So that's something to discuss with your physician. In terms of how you contact any of us, certainly if you want to make I don't know what part of the country you're in, but if you'd like to make a consultation appointment with me, I'm obviously in San Francisco. The number to call would be 415-353-2421. It's possible that I could try to address a quick question via email. However, I have to say at the outset that I get bombarded by emails, and it can be difficult for me to reply to every last email request. And so I can make, unfortunately, no guarantees that I would respond, but my email address is nshaw@medicine.ucsf.edu. So again, I cannot, unfortunately, promise you that I would reply in a timely fashion, but I certainly would do my best. Anyway, thank you very much for the question.
Well, thank you, Dr. Shaw, also, and thank you, Shirley, for really being such a wonderful someone who's really lived with CML for such a long time and is doing really so well. So thank you. And I actually I think that we probably want to just say a little word, maybe Dr. Morrow and Dr. Shaw, about the fact that there are comprehensive centers throughout the country, comprehensive cancer centers of excellence where CML can be treated, and people could identify the centers near them and perhaps contact them as well, or to contact the Cancer Information Service, the 1-800 for cancer number, or actually the trials email address as well. I mean, website that could actually help them with clinicaltrials.gov, which is another resource. But Dr. Morrow and Dr. Shaw, do you want to comment about that? Because do people really need to travel all over the country, or can they actually seek a center close to where they live?
Carolyn, I can help out with this one. I think it's true that sometimes the question is very special, very detailed, maybe very unique, and people may want to travel and to speak to someone who has an extensive experience in CML, but there are indeed very knowledgeable physicians in many different centers, and I think it's all about making sure it's a good fit and doing it in a stepwise manner, and I think Cancer Care and other organizations clearly have ways to help people find the right doctor, to find a physician who has expertise in CML, who can start the process. And if they generally are going to be quite keen to say, I think you need to see this person, or I think this is a very special question, and you might need to travel or to so people don't have to potentially endure a little bit of hardship that may be involved in that without it being absolutely necessary. But I think I echo Neil's comment that all of us that specialize in CML are always glad, and in fact we function a little bit on seeing people who come from a distance because that's what we do, and we're always glad to do it, and we can begin to open the dialogue in a limited sense sometimes over the phone or by email to talk about someone's history and to make recommendations. We always have to see someone to go over their results and to really have a comprehensive look at things. But I think the first place to start is with your own doctor, and I think I'm impressed by the willingness of my colleagues in the community and the region I work in to call me and ask questions about their patients and their willingness to refer. So I think it starts with that, whoever you're on the ground with, right where you are.
I'm sorry, if I may just add one thing. I fully agree with what Dr. Morrow said. I do feel that CML is an increasingly specialized area. So we are obviously learning more and more with every passing year about this disease with respect to the treatments and side effects and how to monitor patients and what is an acceptable level of response and so on. I think one of the unfortunate things is that many physicians who are practicing hematologists or an oncologists are obviously taking care of a broad range of different diseases in patients, everything from breast and colon and lung cancer to blood-related cancers. And so their ability to keep up with the latest developments in a very in a relatively uncommon disease is understandably not the same as somebody who spends a lot of time, in fact, the majority of their time, time thinking about and researching chronic myeloid leukemia. So I do feel that because of that, there are a relatively small number of physicians within the world and certainly within the U.S. who have a level of expertise that's difficult to find anywhere else. Now, not everybody needs that level of expertise by any stretch, but if you do feel that you know, your case may be a bit complicated and then you're not getting the types of answers that you would like from your local physician, if you first start off, you can either first start off by going to a university hospital where hopefully there will be somebody with a strong research interest in CML, or as I said, there are a handful of us scattered throughout the country who really think about this disease an awful lot, and I think bring a little bit more to the table than most other people can. But that's, you know, again, that's probably absolutely necessary for a relatively small proportion of patients.
This is the most, I have to say, most generous and also a really amazing learning piece for everybody on the call to recognize the specialization and the fact that there are physicians like Dr. Morrow and Dr. Shah, that they are very specialized in treating CML. And so so that every comprehensive center actually isn't the place to go. Really, they do need to go to the centers that have CML experts. Am I hearing that correctly?
That's, you know, I think that's certainly my opinion in a select, mm-hmm. you know, in a select number mm-hmm. of select proportion mm-hmm. of cases. You know, I think there are plenty of people. Certainly, if you're doing fine on any of these drugs and you have absolutely no side effects, and you are confident that you are being adequately monitored and that your level of response is great, then, you know, I don't think we would necessarily bring anything to the table. But if you have issues of side effects that you don't think are being adequately addressed, or if you have concerns about it's sad to say, but, you know, now and then, I'm sure the same holds true for Dr. Morrow. I am referred patients who I don't think are getting adequately managed by their local physician. And I worry a little bit about the extent to which this goes on, you know, outside of my local sphere, but obviously, without question, many patients are being, you know, adequately and very well taken care of by their local physicians. And so, as Rick said, I think, you know, I would encourage people to try to really take the bull by the horns and learn as much about this disease and its management as you possibly can. Knowledge is certainly power. And it's been my personal experience that, you know, many, many patients who do this actually get to a point where they understand the disease and the latest and follow the latest results and advances in the disease more carefully than many of the community physicians out there, which, as I said, is completely understandable because they have to keep up with the latest in a large number of diseases, and especially in diseases that are very common where relative to CML. And so I think that's an important issue to keep in mind.
Excellent. Very excellent conversation. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Diane P. Your question, please.
Yes. I wanted to, first of all, echo the sentiments of the two doctors because my son was 25 when he was diagnosed with CML in 2008, and unfortunately he passed away in August of 2009. And we were treated at a very large center, but unfortunately in the hullabaloo of the shock of having your son diagnosed with cancer, I have a lot of regrets of not seeking a second opinion from a CML expert. My question was related to those who are diagnosed in blast crisis, which is what my son was diagnosed in. And he was put on Gleevec, and he went back to chronic phase. But at the time, we were strongly encouraged to go to bone marrow transplant. And we chose to do that, and it was actually complications from the bone marrow transplant, in my opinion, that caused his death. So I really regret not, you know, my son even asked the question, why can I not just stay on the Gleevec? So I was wondering what clinical trials or what kind of outcomes are happening with people. And Dr. Shaw, you touched on that briefly, with people who do have the blast, you know, how long can you go without, you know, having a bad outcome on these new drugs? Because certainly the BMT is an extreme procedure that has a lot of side effects with it, and I don't think people realize that when they go into bone marrow transplant. And I'm a registered nurse, and I did realize that, and then found out I didn't really realize how badly it could go. So I have a lot of regret now that we chose that option, and perhaps maybe he should have had a better quality of life by just staying on the tyrosine kinase inhibitors and taking his chances.
Well, Diane, first of all, we want to say how sorry we are that your son died. I'm going to ask Dr. Morrow and Dr. Shaw both to address your question because it's such an important one. Because I think we always, when something happens, when someone we love died, we wonder, could we have done something different? Is something? So I'm going to ask Dr. Morrow if you could address that, and then Dr. Shaw.
I also offer my condolences that happened, but I think deep down inside we might come to an agreement that he was probably put on a path that was hopefully going to give him the best chances for long-term success. We know that blast phase disease is very much more unstable and chronic, or even certain forms of accelerated phase CML. And we do have response data from second-generation kinase inhibitors, dasatinib in particular, and nilotinib with some more preliminary data. And we have encouraging data potentially from third-generation inhibitors, but our confidence in long-term remissions there is not as, but it are clearly the same as our confidence in chronic phase. So it certainly could be potentially a stable long-term remission in a minority of patients, but we don't want to lose their opportunity to gain the upper hand even more when the disease is put back into chronic phase. So that still is a common pathway, and it really still is our only way. I think with advances in bone marrow transplant, hopefully we'll get to a day when, if a patient does need a bone marrow transplant, it won't pose as much of a risk. But I think it just shows us we have a lot more work to do.
Thank you.
Carolyn, this is Rick. Could I just jump in for a moment? I would just like to say, from a social work perspective, and again, to Diane, my condolences, but when something does happen, and I talked about cancer care providing services to patients and caregivers, but also whether through cancer care or locally, that the issues of grief and guilt and all of those issues are very legitimate issues, and it falls within the uncertainty of cancer. And I do encourage you to seek supports for yourself as you process that loss. And recognize it sounds like the great compassion and love that you had for your son as well, moving forward in that direction.
And this is Neil Shaw. If I can also just say, I'm sorry you had to go through this experience. To lose somebody so young to blast phase CML is obviously tragic. I want to really stress, I think what hopefully came through with what Dr. Morrow said, and that is that, you know, I think for the foreseeable future, I can't see how anybody, any CML expert, would have managed things any differently in your son's case. And the reason is, as Dr. Morrow mentioned, that if you look at how well Gleevec does in terms of even 4 or 5 years down the road in patients with blast phase, with myeloid blast phase CML, unfortunately, it's probably no more than even 10% of patients that have not suffered progressive disease and succumbed to their disease after 4 or 5 years. And it may not even be as high as 10%. It's a very, very low likelihood. And so I think the decision to try to do the the best that one could to ensure that your son had the best chance of long-term survival did involve a bone marrow transplant. But as I mentioned, I think this is an area that as we've gotten better and better at treating chronic phase disease, you know, somewhere around 10 to 15% of people in the United States who are diagnosed with CML are actually already diagnosed in the blast crisis phase. And unfortunately, our treatment outcomes have not dramatically changed the outlook our treatment options have not dramatically changed the outcomes of these blast phase cases. Now, as far as your question about whether there are any particularly exciting clinical trials, I think we know that the second generation drugs have activity, but we know they're also vulnerable to having resistant disease develop. Now, the hope is that we will soon have the ability to effectively treat the most common causes of loss of response, but the general sense has been in the blast phase of the disease that the disease is capable of coming up with some uncommon causes of escaping these drugs. And so I actually think this is an important area of unmet medical need, but at the moment I wish we had some really exciting trials to offer patients that would accomplish for blast phase patients what the tyrosine kinase inhibitors have accomplished for the chronic phase patients. But in all honesty, I don't know of anything, and I can't myself envision anything that's highly promising. So above all else, I think I want to stress you should, put your mind at ease that your son was basically treated the same way any CML expert would, and please have no regrets whatsoever about not having him treated at or consulting with a CML expert, because this is one of those cases where, without question, I would have approached it, and I have approached similar cases. A 33-year-old man not too long ago in a very similar manner and offered transplant during the first remission.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sharon. And Diane, I hope this is helpful to you, and I hope that this can help to put your mind at rest in terms of that you did everything that our expert CML experts are saying would have been done. So thank you for your question, and I want to thank our speakers as well. And again, our condolences to you. And I think that I really want to thank all of our speakers today for their great kind of wisdom and compassion and really information that they provided, expertise to everybody on the call today. I also want to thank all of you who asked really such amazing questions that really enabled our speakers to kind of further elaborate on points for all of you. Although our program is an hour education workshop, I do want to make it clear to everybody that the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those don't end in an hour. Those go on endlessly, and you can access them at any time. And I just want to let you know that we have a staff of 60 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to provide a lot of different help to you, both practical and financial assistance, supportive counseling to you. We also offer support groups on the telephone, online. And we, of course, have many workshops like this workshop as well. And we have many publications and booklets. Most importantly, though, I don't want anyone to leave this call feeling that you are alone with a concern that you may have. I now want you to feel that you're part of a community of support and that we are here for you to help you as you navigate the experience of living and dealing with CML and the concerns that you may have. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect.